From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, the tall, dark, evil-smelling figure from Transylvania, we discuss Dracula and why his legend has endured for 100 years. We talk with Leonard Wolf, an expert on the subject and the author of the book Dracula, The Connoisseur's Guide. Also, we talk with the founder of a baseball program for inner-city youth. John Young is a former Major League scout, and RBI is the name of his program, which is bringing the sport back to urban neighborhoods. This weekend, the RBI holds its World Series. And Milo Miles remembers Fela, who was Nigeria's most popular singer and later emerged as one of its most outspoken dissidents. He died last week. That's all coming up on today's edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Federal investigators are still trying to determine why a Korean Air jumbo jet crashed while trying to land in Guam earlier this week. But they said today there is no evidence of engine or structural failure just before the accident occurred. The crew didn't know of any problems in the few moments before the plane went down. Chief Investigator George Black says the next step may be to recreate the circumstances surrounding the crash, a landing at the Guam International Airport in the dark.
One of the things that we're planning on doing or trying to set up right now is to fly this approach at night in a helicopter that is equipped with an instrument landing system, and they do have those, the larger ones, and then see what this approach looks like at night.
The National Transportation Safety Board says 29 of the 254 people aboard the Korean Air plane survived the crash. Meanwhile, the National Transportation Safety Board hopes to get more data on the cargo plane that crashed yesterday in Miami. A spokesman says the flight data and cockpit voice recorders survived the fiery accident. The information is being reviewed. One thought is that the plane's cargo may have been too heavy or even shifted during the brief flight, causing control problems. The NTSB spokesman says officials will look at the paperwork and talk to the loaders to find out what could have happened. Three of four people aboard the Fine Air flight are dead. The fourth is missing. Two Russian cosmonauts are settling in aboard the space station Mir. They are the replacement crew, with the job of repairing the station following a space collision last June. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
The first step in repairing Mir comes a week from today. That's one day after Mir's current cosmonaut crew members are scheduled to head home. Once Vasily Sibliev and Alexander Lazutkin leave, the two new cosmonauts and American Mike Fole will board their own Soyuz spaceship. The three Mir crewmen will detach their Soyuz from Mir and fly around the station. They want to check out the damage done by an unmanned cargo ship that bumped into Mir. Once the trip is over, the Soyuz will dock at the front of Mir instead of the back docking port where it arrived yesterday. One of Mir's science labs was punctured in the accident. A solar electricity panel was damaged as well. 5 days after this up-close look, the two new cosmonauts will make a risky spacewalk on the inside of Spectre. Pavel Vinogradov will shine a flashlight into Spectre while Anatoly Soloviev squeezes inside. If the spacewalk works, then Mir will be reconnected to batteries inside Spectre. For National Public Radio, I'm Pat Duggins reporting.
President Clinton is urging the Teamsters and United Parcel Service to keep talking. The White House says Mr. Clinton is encouraged that both sides in the UPS strike have met to talk informally. The discussions are the first since the Teamsters struck UPS on Monday. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 139 points at 8,047. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, on Wall Street, the stock market is sharply lower at midday. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner explains.
Stocks are sagging under the weight of rising long-term interest rates. Long rates are at their highest levels in a month, on growing concern that next week's retail sales surveys will indicate increased consumer spending. Also troubling today is a declining dollar, which underscores the fear of higher inflation. Investors are also concerned about the quality of corporate earnings. Electronic Data Systems has lost nearly 15% after the company reported its third consecutive quarter of lower profits. And in the Nasdaq market, PetSmart is down by more than 25% after the specialty retailer issued a profit warning. I'm Doug Krisner.
A published report says the Food and Drug Administration is ready to relax its rule that all television ads about prescription drugs also feature a detailed list of potential side effects. The Wall Street Journal says the FDA is prepared to make the announcement today. Under the new policy, drug firms will have to disclose, using consumer-friendly language, the primary health risks associated with their drugs. The report adds a toll-free number or an internet address must also be displayed for consumers. Workers at a Wisconsin Walmart are voting on whether to unionize. About 95 store employees in Merrill, Wisconsin, are eligible to join the United Steelworkers Union, which also represents retail workers. If they choose to join, they would be the first unionized Walmart in the United States. Retail industry experts say retailers are watching the vote closely. Again, on Wall Street, the Dow is off 139 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 160 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. When Bram Stoker wrote Dracula, reviewers saw it as harmless entertainment, an enjoyable, thrilling read, certainly not destined to be a classic. In the years since its publication, Dracula has never been out of print, and it's been adapted and reinterpreted many times. While Victorian critics made no mention of the novel's erotic subtext, modern critics and readers have mined the tale for its exploration of enduring taboos, homoeroticism, sadism, voyeurism, necrophilia, to name just a few. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the publication of Dracula, which is being marked by celebrations all over the world, including symposia, film festivals, and book readings. One of the world's foremost authorities on Dracula is Leonard Wolfe. He's written a number of books on the topic, including A Dream of Dracula, The Essential Dracula, and his latest, Dracula, The Connoisseur's Guide. He was a consultant on Francis Ford Coppola's screen adaptation of the novel, and he's currently working on a young Dracula series for DC Comics. He was also born in Transylvania. We first spoke last spring, and he told me that even though he first read Dracula when he was 12, it wasn't until he was an adult, teaching at a college, that he got hooked on the novel.
The primary excitement was the discovery that here I was, a professor of English literature, and had not known the literary quality of this astonishing book. I remembered my 12-year-old response of mostly fear. But what I had as an adult in middle life, rereading Dracula after many, many years, was the extraordinary delight, a sort of expanse of light flowing into my head as I found myself reading a first-rate novel.
Why do you think Bram Stoker's novel has never been out of print in the 100 years that it's been written? What do you think each generation has been able to find in this story?
Well, in the decade following its appearance in 1897, I think it was mostly read as an adventure story because he created what we nowadays would call a real page-turner. You really want to know who's doing what to whom, when, where, why, and how all the time. It's a macabre tale, this tall, dark, evil-smelling person from Transylvania who comes to London and then feeds on British womanhood. That's exotic, it's macabre, and Stoker has a very fine plot sense so that you read it for that. For the first two decades, I would say, after the novel appeared, it was read for that. It was not, may I say, a bestseller. It was a steady seller without ever becoming a bestseller. But then the movie industry got hold of it in 1922 with the appearance of F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu. And from that time on, the idea of Dracula began to permeate our culture so that by now, with more than some 400 films based on or in some way reflecting Stoker's novel, the idea of Dracula has taken on the proportions of a folk myth to which everyone in America can and around the world can refer.
Well, this story and this character of Dracula comes from really a long line of myths and folk tales, as you outline in your book. Let's begin with the body and the interest, I assume human beings have had since the beginning of human history, in death and what constitutes death and what a decomposing body does and doesn't do and what it means to be dead and what it means to be undead. Because I would assume in times past there were possibilities of people being buried alive. They might be in a coma and they might look dead when they actually weren't.
That undoubtedly contributes to the folklore of the vampire because the body, you know, in the movies, bodies are very conveniently dead. Somebody takes a shot and somebody falls and that's the end of it. He or she is dead. In the real world, that the moment of death is the beginning of an elaborate physical process, not very pretty, may I say, and I'm not sure we all of us want to know all of the details about that process of decomposition, but it does have certain side effects so that, for example, the body can swell, there are interior gases, the rigor mortis can set in, and in the process of rigor mortis, the muscles contract and the body can assume positions much different from the recumbent position in which we put our loved ones when we put them into coffins. The rigor mortis can sometimes produce effects on the face, for example. When the face collides with the top of the coffin, it can be bruised. If later people open the coffin and they see either swellings on the lips or contusions of one sort or another, it was an easy thing to conclude long ago that the body had come to life and was trying to get out. Now, that would be an accident. On the other hand, since they did not really know how to tell whether someone was dead beyond holding a feather to the lips or sometimes a mirror to see if it moistened, it was not unusual, or at least not unlikely, that occasionally somebody who had had, for instance, who was fallen into a coma, was put into his or her grave prematurely. And the nightmare of that event must have been very, very real. And, of course, Edgar Allan Poe makes quite a bit of that in The Fall of the House of Usher. There is, in my book, I think, an illustration from a 19th century device that was put into coffins so that in the event the body did come to life, there was a string attached to the big toe and the corpse, or the revived corpse, could wiggle his toe, and the string was attached to a bell up in the caretaker's office up on top. It was a patented device, and I hope it did some good.
And it was used, I assume, just because of some of the questions about when death actually occurred.
Of course.
When you look through the vampire literature, the vampire mythology, when do you begin to see some of the early signs?
Well, there is a vampire tale that goes back to the 2nd century. It's in Apuleius's The Golden Ass. And somewhere in this book, I think I've said that vampire folklore takes place wherever anybody has seen anybody bleed. It seems such an obvious thing that if you see someone bleeding copiously, that person is going to die unless somebody staunches the wound. It follows rather logically, if a little bit disturbingly, that if A loses blood and B takes blood, B will live longer than A. So the easiest thing to conclude is that in order to ensure longer life, you should take blood. And indeed, there were medieval remedies in the Roman period. There were people who occasionally drank blood in hopes that it would extend their lives.
Well, I'm thinking even about the ritual in the Christian church of communion, which is considered taking the blood and body of Christ. That seems very related to this idea of drawing blood in vampires.
Yes, and the mystery of transubstantiation and consubstantiation turns on, however, on a spiritual mystery, and that is to say the blood, though in Catholic tradition is actually Christ's blood, it is the blood of salvation. It comes with the promise of salvation, and the novel Dracula parenthetically turns on an inversion of that idea. Stoker's Dracula promises immortal life just as Christ does, but under the sponsorship of Satan. And in under the sponsorship of Satan, you achieve immortal life by destroying your fellow humans, which is something that does not happen under the sponsorship of Christ.
We'll talk more with Leonard Wolf about Dracula after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Dracula expert Leonard Wolf. His latest book on the vampire is Dracula, The Connoisseur's Guide. Let's talk about the neck, because certainly one of the enduring images of the vampire mythology has to do with the vampire, with Dracula leaning over the exposed neck of a usually very beautiful young woman. Do you see the neck as the erogenous zone?
Well, yes, I do. Your question is actually so complex that you hear me hesitating, because almost all of us who have been raised by loving mothers and fathers will remember nestling against the neck of our mothers or our fathers, and will remember them nestling against our necks, you know, doing the sort of silly things that daddies and mommies do to little children to comfort them, to warm them, to prove to them that they love them. And the neck is a favorite place for that kind of nuzzling. Then there comes adolescence, where before boys and girls are really ready for sex, some of them experience what in my generation was called a monkey bite, but I gather has been renamed. What do you now call it?
I think, well, I'm a little old for this, but kids my son's age call it a hickey.
That's right, hickey. That was the word that was escaping me. But you can tell my age from the fact that I still think of it as a monkey bite. So that what they're doing, of course, is they're experiencing a kind of precursor of the sexual event. There's a little tiny bit of pain, and there's a lot of intimacy and a lot of warmth and a certain amount of giggling connected to it all. But think for a moment, the neck is also the place where the main arteries to the brain flow.
Right.
And, of course, it's the site of where Dracula gets his nourishment when he takes nourishment from his victims. So, yes, the neck is a complex place for the kind of intimacy we would like to see us all experience. It is also an exposed place where the life's blood flows. But the more critical thing in terms of reading the novel Dracula or watching the Dracula films, we have to keep in mind a kind of Freudian reality called displacement upward.
Right.
And that is what we see happening between the vampire and his or her victim is what we know should happen below the waist. But we can't bring ourselves to accept that it is really below the waist where the generating members are. So we displace the event upwards, and so what we see in the vampire's embrace is an authentic sexual exchange.
So it's the neck kind of masquerading as genitalia.
Well, or as the stage for the erotic event. The neck is, you know, in the films, it's really rather wonderful. I thought it would be great to create a film sometimes in which we took all of the vampire approaches to the neck and flash them one after the other so that you see Max Schreck in 1922 and Bela Lugosi in 1931 and Christopher Lee in 1957, all of them approaching the victim who was lying recumbent with her neck exposed. And they would end up looking pretty much like Groucho Marx. But aside from the hilarity of it all, it is perceived, really perceived, and in the latest movies, in Bram Stoker's Dracula, mm-hmm. the Francis Ford Coppola film, it's perceived as an extraordinarily erotic moment.
Well, I think it is one of the more enduring images that's come out of all the vampire and Dracula stories and retellings of the story. This woman either offering up or in a passive way being offered up through her neck.
Yes. And in Nosferatu, for example, she offers it up as a willing sacrifice to save the town or to save the country from the plague that Count Orlok has brought to Bremen. She reads in a little book that if a pure woman can distract the vampire long enough so that he doesn't hear the cock crow in the morning. And so she all but exposes herself at the window so that Orlok sees her, and then he clumps over, climbs the stairs, enters. She sends her husband away. It's really, the dynamics of the thing is very much a French bedroom comedy, except that it's really horrible. And then Max Schreck enters looking like the most appalling monster you've ever seen, with long, long fingernails, a very hooked nose, pointed ears, and a sort of hunchback. And he kneels beside her bed, and we never know actually what is happening, except that all of a sudden he looks up, and the rooster crows, and he is aware that his life is now over because he's overstayed his leave, and she, on the other hand, is about to die. We see her give a little convulsive death twitch as the movie ends, so that she has understood that her role is a Christian role. She offers herself up the way Christ did to save humankind.
As a kind of human sacrifice.
Yes, indeed.
I wonder if you think about Bram Stoker's Dracula and the way women are portrayed in that kind of story, whether you see it as a cautionary tale to women about what can happen to them if they break the rules or they step out of the bounds of society, or perhaps even taste sex, if even just for a moment.
I think when Stoker was writing, he could not have known that was possible, that it was possible to read his novel that way. What he has is the vampire is merely a terrible threat to the women. He takes their blood and he can turn them into satanic creatures. It was the post-Freudian readers who recognized that Dracula's embrace eroticized the women. They are eroticized in the novel, but I don't think Stoker would believe himself responsible for having conveyed that idea. But later, and there are readers and there are critics who have seen in the Dracula story and in the myriads of films made based on it, stories in which particularly the male sensibility warns women that if they become erotic, they will get a stake through their hearts.
They will die.
They will die. Something very, very bad. It's sort of a post-Victorianism that seems still to linger on in the filmmakers.
It's curious, and I actually have a book that has some reviews of Bram Stoker's novel Dracula when it came out, and many of them saw it as a tale of adventure, certainly a scary story. Some cautioned, you know, don't read this while it's dark outside. But I'm thinking about gothic fiction and much of it having to do with these taboos of incest and murder and voyeurism and torture and on and on and on. You say that a lot of the gothic fiction of the Victorian era was read by women, and it's hard to imagine that they didn't see all the stuff that seems so obvious to us today.
It was not only read by women, it was written by women,
right,
which is even more astonishing. I have suggested in print that there is a very good reason for that, and that is gothic fiction, which enters English literature about the end of the 18th century, was the place, if I may mix a metaphor, it was created the rug under which all of the unspeakable human acts could be swept. And women were the victims of any number of those unspeakable acts. So they found in these stories a kind of resonance to their own situation. What I've suggested, for example, is that the standard villain in a gothic novel was a tall, dark Italian who was pursuing a pure, white, virginal English woman, or woman, sometimes it's a French woman or an Italian woman, but she's white, wealthy, pure, and he pursues her with unspeakable intent. We all know what that means. He wants to rape her.
Right.
That's the sort of the machinery that makes gothic fiction move. Within that large framework is included incest of one sort or another, torture of one sort or another. And what I'm suggesting is that the lot of women in the 18th century, in the 19th century, and perhaps, one tends to hope not, into our own century, was so frequently mirrored in these stories. Somebody was abusing a woman all the time somewhere, that women took a kind of bizarre interest. I don't mean pleasure, but at least interest in it. And what is even more interesting to a critic like myself is that they often wrote the fiction and imagined some extraordinarily bizarre scenes.
Let's talk about someone that actually did live, and his name was Vlad the Impaler, the infamous Vlad the Impaler. As a native of Transylvania, which you were born in Romania, which prior to that, or many centuries before that, was called Transylvania, was this a figure, a man that was talked about when you were growing up in Romania?
Well, two things need to be, maybe more than two things need to be pointed out. First, Vlad Tepes is considered by Romanians to this day as something of a national hero because he was indeed a very courageous fighter against the Turks and the Turkish invaders. But he was also, in his own time, notorious for the cruelty with which he treated his prisoners and his own people. In the prisoners, of course, he killed and tormented because they were his enemies. But his own people he killed and tormented in the name of maintaining order, which is a rather cruel reason to do some of the things he did. He was not, however, a vampire.
Hmm.
And what Stoker did was he borrowed the name and the cruelty and imposed it on his fictional character. You must keep in mind that I left Transylvania as a child of six, so that I have no real memory of anybody talking to me about vampires. But when I revisited Transylvania in the 70s, when I was writing my first book on Dracula, the Transylvanians with whom I spoke were surprised at my interest, which did not by any means reflected in their interest. They had almost no interest either in vampires or in Vlad Tepes as a source of vampire lore, and particularly not in Dracula. Much has changed since then. Since then, two people at Boston University, Radu Florescu and Raymond McNally, have done several books on the historical Dracula, and then my own books on Dracula have appeared over the decades, and that has helped to create a tourist industry into Transylvania, which the Romanian government has been very happy to exploit.
Leonard Wolf is a Dracula expert. His latest book is Dracula, A Connoisseur's Guide. He'll talk more about this legendary vampire in the second half of the show. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation about Dracula with Leonard Wolf and reviving baseball in the inner cities. We talk with former Major League scout John Young about the baseball program he founded to work with urban youth. And Milo Miles remembers Nigerian dissident musician Fela. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the publication of Bram Stoker's classic gothic tale, Dracula. We're celebrating that event with an interview with one of the world's leading authorities on Dracula and horror, Leonard Wolfe. His latest book on the subject is Dracula, A Connoisseur's Guide. He's also developing a series on young Dracula for DC Comics.
Well, I'm thinking about Bram Stoker, and much has been made of his relationship with the actor Henry Irving, who was one of the more popular actors at the late 19th century. Bram Stoker was actually a manager at the theater where Henry Irving performed. How would you describe how Bram Stoker saw his relationship with this rather famous actor, Henry Irving?
Well, in my book, I've taken a terrible risk. I have outed Bram Stoker, and I say very carefully that I'm speculating, but what the speculation is based on the details of the lives they led together. Bram Stoker fell in love with Henry Irving very early in his own career, and then Irving invited him to come and work for him in London, and for some 28 years, Stoker was a loyal, dutiful, even slavish servant for Henry Irving. And what I have suggested in my book is that it's the unhappy part of Stoker's life was that he never could confront the fact that he was in love with Irving, and he never did anything about what I think is the incipient homosexuality, which he betrayed in other ways. There are a series of letters he wrote to Walt Whitman, for example, that make it very, very clear that he admired Whitman for what he imagined was Whitman's comfort with his own homosexuality. It's a heartbreaking story, the way in which Stoker spent his life not coming to terms with his own deepest hungers.
Well, you write about and actually pull from Bram Stoker's own either letters or diaries about seeing this actor, Henry Irving, perform. And he really falls into a kind of a swoon as he sees him, this very famous actor, performing on stage. And it's almost melodramatic.
It's a heartbreaking story because Irving recited a poem, a really soppy poem, and Stoker fainted dead away at the sound and the sight of it. And then later, Irving gave him a copy of a photograph of his signed with his name, and it was a sort of moment of profound, a high point in Stoker's life. The bystander, we who read this story 80 or 90 years later, can't help feeling that he could not bring himself to acknowledge what had happened. And I think that that's too bad.
And are you saying, because certainly when you read through Dracula, it's about many things, but what you're also saying is that it really has this kind of homoerotic subtext?
I said long ago, I've created an edition of Dracula called The Essential Dracula, in which I have notes for every moment in the fiction, which I think requires some note. There are moments when Dracula says, for example, to the three women who want Jonathan Harker, and Dracula drives them away, and he says, "This man is mine." And Dracula looks deep into Stoker's eyes. Well, that's not a moment in which, he's behaving like Robin Hood. What that is a homoerotic exchange, which is never fully developed. And there have been other scholars who have gone to considerable lengths to demonstrate the degree to which Stoker either avoided confronting homosexual moments in the novel or inadvertently put them in.
Mm. You said, and I don't know whether this was a slip on your part, but that the Dracula looked into Stoker's eyes as opposed to Jonathan Harker's eyes. But do you see them almost as one in the same?
Well, what I'm doing, and it's really unpardonable, one has no right to deduce from the life of a writer a clear link to the contents of a fiction by that writer. I think that's an exercise in facile criticism, and I've just done it, and I would like to step back a little bit from it. What I'm willing to say is Stoker's mind and his unconscious were in turmoil. they were in such turmoil that when he sat down to write Dracula, the turmoil itself produced the energy that resulted in the vision and the language and the plot line that produced a very great novel.
When you review all the movies that have been made about Dracula, which one do you think comes the closest to your image, your version of Dracula?
Well, that's another one of these wonderful questions, because what you're asking me to do is to be the god of the Dracula movie business, and that would be great for fun to be. I have to say first that I don't hold the movies responsible for interpreting Bram Stoker's novel exactly. Mm-hmm. I think film is an art form all unto itself, and fiction is an art form unto itself. They can influence each other, but they do not need to interpret each other. Having said that, the film that moves me most is Dracula's Daughter, because it has a scene in it in which Gloria Holden plays Dracula's daughter, who, now that Dracula is dead, hopes that the curse of vampirism will leave her life and she can become an ordinary woman. And, of course, the rest of the film demonstrates that she can't. It's a very poignant, poignant film, beautifully realized in the scenes of ritual, particularly when she's burying her father. Beyond that, Coppola's film did its best to include most of the scenes that Stoker has written. Stoker's novel, you know, is overpopulated. It has, from a movie point of view, it has too many characters. And Coppola has managed to retain them all. And what James Hart Coppola version does, however, is that it inverts Stoker's story and turns what Stoker thought of as the good guys into the bad guys. Dr. Van Helsing and his troop are trying to prevent Vlad Tepes from uniting with his true love, whom he has been looking for the last 400 years. So that in an important sense, it's a heretical interpretation. But I like to think and am delighted to see that the films are endlessly reinventing Dracula, which is the right thing for a great symbol, the right way to treat a great symbol.
Well, I know that you're in the process of creating a young Dracula for DC Comics. And some people have said that when you look at Dracula over the last 100 years, he's getting younger and younger. Do you agree with that?
Well, what else he's getting is nicer
yes,
and nicer.
Right, right.
and that seems to me too bad. when you have that probably happened most dramatically with Frank Langella's Dracula. I've called Frank Langella's Dracula the cuddly Dracula, because it's hard for me to imagine any woman looking into Langella's eyes who wouldn't give up, you know, some portion of eternity to be his victim for a little while. They are getting nicer and nicer, and there has been a reversal of moral meaning for the vampire, so that in the works of Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough, for example, we have a vampire who is profoundly nice. He's decent, he's law-abiding, he's rich, he wears a cross, and he only takes as much blood from his willing victims as will nourish him. I think something will disappear from vampire literature when the vampires become nice guys.
So your young Dracula, is he a nice guy or a nasty guy?
Well, what I've done in my young Dracula is to give the world for the very first time a clear, coherent, and terrifying explanation for why he drinks blood. I won't tell you here and now. Obviously, come.
Well, there's the suspense, right? Which
is,
of course, a very
idea.
Important part of the story.
That's the idea. No, I treat him very sympathetically, but he sustains a terrible... He has a dreadful experience that therefore turns him into the monster we now have. But until that experience, he's a nice guy.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Leonard Wolf, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
Leonard Wolf is the author of Dracula, A Connoisseur's Guide. He's working on a young Dracula series for DC Comics due out later this year. And this fall, Oxford University Press will publish an anthology edited by Leonard Wolf called Bloodthirst, 100 Years of Vampire Fiction. This is Fresh Air. Jackie Robinson broke baseball's color line 50 years ago and became a hero to every black child who dreamed of playing in the major leagues. But today, the percentage of African-American players playing professional baseball is just 17%, well behind basketball and football. My guest, John Young, wants to reverse that trend. In 1989, he founded RBI, Reviving Baseball in Inner Cities. It's supported by funds from Major League Baseball and works to increase interest in the sport by organizing teams and tournaments. It also works with boys and girls, encouraging them to stay in school. Today, there are RBI programs in 75 cities across the country, and beginning this weekend, they hold their World Series championship at Coors Field in Denver. John Young played baseball as a kid in South Central L.A. where he grew up and was offered $500 a month to play pro ball. His father said no, he had to go to college first. Well, after graduation, Young played first base in the minor leagues through most of the 1970s. An injury curtailed his major league career with the Detroit Tigers. He then worked as a scout for the Tigers. We first spoke last spring, and I asked him when he first noticed baseball was disappearing from inner city neighborhoods.
The first week I became a scout. I was living in Alabama at the time, Montgomery, and I was working with the Tigers, and I had four states of Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Florida, and Georgia, five states. And as I would travel into Birmingham, New Orleans, Atlanta, all the major cities, you know, in those states, and scout the high school players, I really noticed a difference in the participation with African Americans and the quality of the programs in the inner city schools. As we scouted the colleges, we would notice that unless it was a historically black school, there weren't many African Americans playing college baseball. So right away, it was just so noticeable.
What was the concept then behind the program that you started? Again, this was in the late 80s, this program called RBI.
I moved up to Detroit as director of scouting, and I really, as we would attend baseball organization meetings with other scouting directors, you know, the subject would still come up. We've got to find talent. We've got to find another resource of talent. We've got to do something with inner cities. We've got to do something, get more athletes involved. And then I moved back to Southern California, and I was working for the San Diego Padres as a scout. And same thing, I'm talking, this is like 84, 85, and I'm talking to the same subject with a different group of scouts. Hmm. So finally, in 1987, I got together with Roland Heeman, who was the general manager of the White Sox and general manager of the Orioles, but in between that was working in the commissioner's office, and expressed my concerns, and he suggested that I write a proposal and send it to, at the time, Commissioner Peter Uberoff, and that's exactly, you know, what we did. Sent the proposal to Peter Uberoff. He gave us funding for the first year, and RBI appeared to be off and running.
Well, you began in South Central L.A., where you grew up. What happened the first day of tryouts?
Prior to the first day of tryouts, we went into the local junior high schools, and we had some really impressive alumni, you know, with us. So when we went into one junior high school, we went in with one of their former alumni, Eric Davis. We went to another junior high school with Daryl Strawberry, with Hubie Brooks, and it was very impressive. And the kids were all fired up about, you know, this new league. And we gave the kids the first year jackets to wear, and everybody was excited. And when we told them the locations of the parks, you know, it was just silence, and we really didn't pick up on it, you know, and we just didn't pick up on it. And the problem was the kids were concerned with the locations over crossing over gang territory, and So it was concerned, and we met with the Recreation and Parks people, and who, incidentally, the RBI does not get off the ground had it not been for the City of Los Angeles Department of Recreation and Parks. Mm-hmm. They provide the facilities and really the manpower. But we went to the supervisors, and they provided rangers. You know, they have park rangers that were there, and we assured the kids that security would be no problem. We also, you know, went to the community police stations and made them aware of what we were doing. So they would, you know, they would drive by, and then they would, like, you know, get out and they would walk the park, and their presence was felt.
Interesting. Well, I'm curious, too, whether you ever talked with any of gang members there, if you were at a park and there was, I don't know, kids hanging around, whether you ever went over and talked to them.
Well, you know, actually, prior to the start of RBI, you know, part of the research, you know, I had a cousin that was a gangbanger. And, you know, I talked with him about this. I said, you know, this is one problem. I was just saying, well, why would the gangbangers, you know, prevent these kids from doing something positive? See, a lot of scouts are afraid to come into South Central because of this problem. And one of the things I was telling him, I says, you know, this is something that if you have, if the scouts are afraid to come into the area, you're hurting the community. You're hurting the kids in the area because that's going to limit their opportunity to be exposed to, you know, professional baseball, to college baseball, to what have you. And what he told me was that the gangbangers really don't bother the activity at the park. And most of the activity at the park is done at night, and that it would not be a problem.
And so, has it ever been a problem?
Knock on wood, it hasn't. One thing that we, in Southern California, the big gangs are the Crips and the Bloods, which are with the red and blue colors. So we had to outfit our league the first couple of years, you know, without using red or blue. And, you know, if you've been involved in with your youngsters, try to outfit a 24-team league baseball without using red and blue. It becomes very difficult.
Because you probably don't want to do too many of those pinks and other kinds of color.
Exactly.
So what can baseball teach young people, even apart from other sports? I mean, I think all sports teach winning and losing and good sportsmanship. But what do you think is distinctive about the game of baseball and what it can teach, especially a young person?
The thing about baseball that I think is unique from every other profession, every other sport, is that it teaches you to really deal with failure. You look at a 300 hitter who's a star. He fails 7 out of 10 times.
Right.
And I think that's the number one. You know, it teaches you to you know, deal with adversity, dependency on the other members, and I think it teaches you humility. And I think those are really the key points.
There's another part of this program which I think is very interesting, which is to link baseball, to link athletics with learning. And I know that's a very important part of this RBI program. How do you make that link for a young person? Do they have to make sure their homework is done or have certain kinds of grades in order to be part of the team?
Well, let me kind of give you a little background on how the educational component was devised. When I wrote the commissioner, Peter Ubroff, the first time to get the program started, one of the points that I made with Peter Ubroff was that in 1986, from the draft, the June free agent draft, of the players that were signed from America through the draft, not counting the Dominican Republicans, but through the draft, 82% came from college. As compared to when I signed in the late 60s, most of the players that were signing came from high schools.
Interesting.
So my thinking was that for the workforce, that as major league clubs cut back on minor league clubs for economics, that eventually baseball is going to use the colleges similar to the way the NBA and NFL use the colleges, really to cut back on scouting and player development. That's the trend that we're taking. Also, I noticed that when we did our survey, that of the players from America that were in the major league, on major league rosters, 45% of them came from Southern California. That's from Fresno to San Diego. Then we did a survey on who was attending colleges. So we did a survey on the rosters from San Diego to Fresno, California. And we found that less than 2% were African American, less than 3% of the players were Latino.
Hmm.
So that told me that if this is going to be our trend, and that if there's only 2%, you know, minority participation at the colleges, then 10 years from now, we won't have any American minorities playing baseball. So we felt that it was important to get the academic component in place.
Is there a kid you think that really exemplifies what this RBI program is all about? A kid that really, I don't know, uses this experience to his own betterment?
Well, I think the one kid that and he's always been my favorite. In fact, he played, I think, day one by the name of James Lofton. Came in the program at 13. Horrendous home life. Mother was on drugs. Very low self-esteem. Very small in stature. Came in at 13. Played on every RBI team that we had. I always kid and say that he probably has more RBI uniforms than we do. But he got bigger. He got stronger. He got more self-confidence. And when he graduated from high school, he was like the city player of the year, and he attended L.A. Community College. And that really surprised me because I didn't think that when this kid first came into the program that he would do the things that he's accomplished. He signed a contract with the Cincinnati Reds, and he's currently playing in their minor league system. I don't know if James is going to play in the major leagues, but the day that he entered L.A. City Community College was probably the proudest day for me and the program to see how far he had come. And here's a kid that played in the program, never paid one dime to play in the program. So we were able to give this youngster a great experience, uniforms, trophies, and for absolutely free. And I really believe that this is a life that we've saved.
Well, John Young, it's been a real pleasure to have you with us today on Fresh Air, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Marty. It was my pleasure.
John Young is the founder of RBI, reviving baseball in inner cities. Their World Series begins this weekend in Denver. Coming up, we remember Nigerian singer Fela. This is Fresh Air. Nigerian singer Fela was considered one of the most popular and innovative musicians in Africa. He died last Saturday of complications from AIDS at the age of 58. Fela was a songwriter and bandleader who played the sax and keyboards. Music critic Milo Miles remembers the life and work of a performer who made every album and every show a celebration of ordinary people and an attack on authority.
Everybody run, run, run. Everybody scatter, scatter. Some people lost some bread. Someone nearly died. Someone just died. Police, they come, army, they come. Confusion everywhere. 7 minutes later, all done cool down, brother. Police don't go away. Army don't disappear. Them leave sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular trademark.
Them leave sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular trademark.
Them regular trademark.
Them regular trademark.
That is why.
Yeah.
Everybody run, run, run.
Yeah.
Everybody scatter, scatter.
Yeah.
Someone nearly died.
Yeah.
Some people lost some bread.
Yeah.
Someone just died.
Yeah.
Police, they come, army, they come.
Yeah.
Confusion everywhere.
Fela Anikalapo Kuti was usually just called Fela, like Elvis or Madonna. This was only right because he was the first African rock star, and still the grandest. He did not play rock and roll as such. But he was a rock star because he understood the role and lived it to the hilt. The music he did play was a unique blend of African highlife with James Brown and soul jazz. Fela called it Afrobeat. His father was a minister and a music teacher, so Fela preached to both his bands and his fans nonstop. His mother was a prominent crusader in Nigeria's nationalist movement, so Fela was a political fighter, too. After he was exposed to the Black Panther philosophy and the soul power funk of James Brown on a visit to America, Fela began to attack tyranny wherever he found it, whether international corporations, the Nigerian military, or the school system. As his long, rambling jams advocated pride and independence, Fela behaved as he wanted. He became a blatant pot smoker. He became an outspoken polygamist with more than 24 wives. He owned a nightclub and lived in an armored mansion he called the Calicutta Republic. He would release a half dozen albums a year, each one selling hundreds of thousands. His songs grew into wild, intoxicating extravaganzas, half party and half oration. The best of them bristled with tough horn licks and irresistible layered percussion. Once he became a pop celebrity, Fela always seemed to be in trouble. The military stormed his mansion in 1977 and burned it. He was thrown into jail on trumped-up charges in 1984 and served 18 months. He never relented and continued to make his big enemies look small. But in the end, he was brought down by the same virus that finished his only true rival in popularity throughout Africa, Soukous inventor Franco from Congo. There can be no replacement for Fela. He will endure as an African radical artist, carved out of monolithic bedrock.
Milo Miles is a music writer living in Cambridge. He remembered Nigerian musician Fela, who died last week at the age of 58. Joan Tuohy-Westman produced today's show. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Tracy Tannenbaum, Kathy Wolf, Laura Womack, and Monique Nazareth. For Terry Gross, I'm Artie Moss-Cohen.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Tommy Smothers. Our TV critic David Bianculli talks with the man who in the late 60s helped pave the way for a new generation of TV comedies. This year marks the 30th anniversary of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. Join us for the next Fresh Air.